You're listening to Distraction Therapy with Rob Watson. Conversations about how we find meaning in our lives and what it's like to be part of a meta-modern world. Hello, Rob Watson here, and this is Distraction Therapy, and I'm joined again by Ryan Clayton.
Hello.
And I'm trying to get started this morning. We've come into Leicester for a coffee. The caffeine hasn't kicked in yet, and we're just going to sit and have a chat for a while, as ever. And we haven't planned what we're going to talk about, but we think we'll kind of, as the caffeine kicks in, we'll be a bit more ebullient. Is that a good word to use? Or is that, that's maybe the wrong word, but a bit more forthcoming with, or I will.
I wish I could say I'd heard that word before.
Well, there you go. That's your new word for the day. So, we always start off by asking what's been distracting us over the last couple of weeks. Is there anything that you can report back on that you've been up to, that you've done, that you've, things you've seen, things you're reading that you might be of interest?
Let me think. I've been listening to Harry Styles' new album. That's not very interesting, but it's certainly been distracting.
I've changed my opinion of you now.
Just some, you know, light, fluffy pop music to get me through the day. What else? I've been starting to watch The Umbrella Academy on Netflix, because I really loved those comics by Gerard Way. Just really like fantastic reconstruction of a teen superhero story through a very hesitant to say postmodern, but kind of like a very surrealist lens where like anything can happen. A lot of very strange dreamlike elements to it. Off the back of that, I started reading some more of Gerard Way's comics, Doom Patrol. I think there's a Doom Patrol TV show as well, but that's again like another very surrealist take on superheroes, and very much leaning into like the stranger elements of the superhero mythos. Like there's a transvestite sentient street called Danny that teleports around the world picking
a sentient street.
Okay. that picks up people that don't fit in anywhere else and don't have anywhere else to go, which I thought was quite fun. I don't know, typical sort of stuff for me, I suppose. Comic books and strange pop culture. What about you, Rob? What's been distracting Rob Watson these days?
Oh, gosh. Well, I watched the Stranger Things and Star Wars, Obi-Wan Kenobi, but I think it's a bit too early to kind of talk about them at this point. So
maybe.
We've
talked about Star Wars at length as well in the past.
Quite. Yeah. So I'm not really sure I've got any deep insight in, other than that, okay, they were entertaining for a few hours. You know, sit there with a cup of tea and there's some snacks and watch a Friday night watching stuff on TV.
Yeah. What I will say though is I feel like, because they released the first two episodes of Obi-Wan Kenobi, didn't they? That's a strange model to release a TV show. Because I do like the weekly releases of shows, because it gives you a chance to enjoy them properly and fully, and it allows it time to breathe. But if you're going to release the first two episodes at once, I don't understand why you wouldn't just make the first episode longer. I've never quite clocked onto that.
Yeah, I suppose it operates on a different kind of, because it is episodic, and it is, I suppose it, once all the episodes are available, then you can watch them in small sections. Mm. So rather than watching like a 2-hour movie, you can press pause and go back to it. But there is a natural point at which in the story, it's, you know, an hour long or whatever it is, that it reaches this point. So I don't know how many episodes it's going to be. I think six episodes maybe, so there's like 6 hours of story to get through, so to hold your attention for that long. And you know, they're based on serials in the first place, so that, you know, it's well suited to that kind of form of storytelling. There's a cliffhanger at the end or something, so it's Yeah, I mean, it's you know, obviously very well done. It's okay. It's
well, the amount of money that's put into these things, you'd hope they were well done.
Yeah, well, you would, but sometimes they're not, are they? So, because you know, there's kind of how far can you go with these things, and how much can they, you know, kind of be put on a pedestal? And I think the danger is that there was a lot of hype built up over the last few weeks about this, that they were, you know, kind of. Somehow, you know, some kind of great leap forward in storytelling or filmmakers. Like, no, it's the return of a couple of characters that, you know, kind of you're going down a cul-de-sac with them rather than focusing on the main drive of the narrative.
Yeah, and again, I think it's a strange thing for hype to be built around. I mean, I understand that, Obi-Wan Kenobi and that sort of area of Star Wars, like the prequel stuff, was, like, I mean, it was a massive part of my childhood because that's when they were coming out. And I suppose the same can be said for a lot of other people now that are, like, got disposable income to spend on Disney Plus. But, I mean, those films are just really, like, dull and boring. I remember not long ago, going back when people started to say that actually they're quite good, and I watched the first two. I think I watched the first one and a half actually, because I just thought, you know what? Oh my god!
Well, I've kind of lost the, you know, it's plentiful and available. You know, you've got them. You know, I've got them on DVD. You know, Blu-ray. You know, at one point there was a kind of a satisfaction from watching A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back, because they. You know, they just happen to be well-crafted films, and it's almost like something you get them out of the box and they tell themselves, kind of stuff. Whereas with the others, you're right, that, you know, the prequels are laboured, and but then they're trying to do a different kind of job with a very new at the time kind of filmmaking, which is a lot of digital techniques which haven't been done prior to that.
I mean, that is impressive, I'll give you that. But it's more so the story of them that I find to be really boring, and the way that they're told. It's like...
Yeah, the character arc of the fall from the hero was kind of... It was like a bit like kind of painted by numbers, really, wasn't it? You know, it's kind of... You know, the motivation wasn't really felt... it was explained, you know, and you had to go through the exposition of it all and everything. So, but that was, you know, that it came from the same mind of as the people who, you know, George Lucas's head. But you know, you can go down that, you know, you can get into one of these big fanboy things about Star Wars, and
yeah,
and it just becomes endless, you know, endless hours on YouTube of people pulling apart the minutiae. As if it actually matters and it makes a difference, and it's like, you know, go and get a life.
Yeah, I don't know. I do understand it, to be fair, but it felt like, you know, even with those New Hope and Empire Strikes Back, I like those films because they're good films, but they're not, I don't know. Once you've seen them a couple of times, like, okay, I get it now.
Well, it's not Dr. Zhivago, is it?
No.
It's like, you know.
God, I mean, it makes me sound like a snob, but I'm not. I feel like I'm not a snob, but I don't know. There's something about Star Wars that just doesn't do it for me.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's okay on a certain level, but if you're looking for, you know, deep, you know, it is. I know it's like that kind of Joseph. You know, lots of people got excited because, you know, Lucas used. You know, Joseph Campbell and other people around that time, in terms of explaining, you know, constructing the narrative and constructing the archetypes with it, as playing with that very well. But you can overread these things. It is a form of entertainment and escapism. And for, I think, you know, you get caught in the hype machine of overselling it, and that, you know, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that this is somehow culturally important. When it's only part of a cultural mix of things, rather than it being, you know, I mean, if you put it in the context of, you know, certainly Western culture, you know, it is a momentary expression. There are things that have been and gone equally, you know, have been lauded in their time, but which are now forgotten about. And which, you know, kind of were regarded as kind of, you know, ever, you know, a classic would be something like Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah.
No cultural resonance today.
No.
And yet, you know, in the 100 years ago, it was the most significant, you know, kind of creative expression on the planet, with millions and millions of people adoring that kind of work.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because it part of me wonders, like, you know, with these Star Wars films and the TV shows and stuff, how they'll hold up after the same amount of time, because I feel like it's a different experience than it obviously was at the time to go back and watch one of those silent Charlie Chaplin films. I remember watching, I can't remember. Was it Hard Times? Was that the title? I can't remember. The one which is all about, like, industrialization and mechanization, with the famous scene where he gets, like, caught on the conveyor belt and stuff. And that there are elements of those that are funny, and you can sit there and watch them and still enjoy them, but it is still a bit of a... Because filmmaking has come along such a long way since then, it is still a bit of a slog to sit through. I wonder if Star Wars will suffer the same thing.
Probably. You know, once the novelty wears off, you know, and that's always the case, and that's, you know, and a new generation will come forward with a new form of storytelling that they, and there will be a repeat or a use of different archetypes. And it also, I think, it depends. You know, the archetypal nature of these things is quite interesting. Is for something to be popular, it's not the artifact, the product that is popular. It's the how popularity is expressed. Does that make sense?
I think so. Yeah.
So it's, you know, so it catches on to something, and it comes to be a symbol of that mood and sense of what is popular, and this is just one of the things that kind of catches that tide, if you like, and gets floated, and extends above others. But the tide changes, and things move on, and other forms of popular engagement take over. I mean, at one point, you know, very much thought in the 1960s that cinema was a moribund industry. And that it was, you know, it was on, you know, and they were trying more and more gimmicks and going to more, you know, kind of, you know, films like Cleopatra come to mind, you know, 4 hours long and hugely, hugely cinematic, but, you know, doesn't really, you know, as you say, it's interesting of its time, but not really, you know, culturally relevant beyond that. And so it became, you know, you had that pushback, which was the American independence of Scorsese and people like that, and De Palma and stuff, which came out of the 60s, which
came, early George Lucas as well, ironically. Well,
so cinema was reinvented as something which was much more closer to kind of urban underground cinema, much, much cheaper, and then caught the imagination. But then it was reinvented again as something, because it's, you know, you just... It's one of those. It's elastic or plastic. You know, it's reshapeable.
Feels somewhat cyclical as well, because now it feels like we're sort of in an analogous point of cinema now, where the films are getting bigger and bigger and more expensive and longer. You know, more and more stars being attached to these things. I mean, look at all of the talent that these Marvel movies are just. Soaking up and integrating into the massive machine. So it'll be interesting to see what the kind of, you know, when the elastic snaps back again, what kind of cheaper, more underground things capture the imagination of the public next. I'm thinking like Alex Garland's movies, like Ex Machina, that new one he's got coming out that's just called Men. Is it... A24, that's it. Which is, it kind of does feel a bit like a response to that, like a kind of organized attempt at making slightly more thoughtful art house cinema, but with like there's still a sleekness there. There's still a well-made, well-funded shine to pretty much all of those films. I don't know if you've seen any of them.
Do you know, this sounds terrible, but I'm really not much into independent cinema.
Yeah.
I'm
can I call you a Philistine now?
Well, to be honest with you, I find a lot of it quite boring. I mean, I saw the trailer for the new David Cronenberg film. I was like, I'm not watching that. I'm not letting that into my head.
No, I love David Cronenberg. Anything that'll give me nightmares. Yeah, and there's the trailer for the new George Miller film as well. I don't know if you've seen that. Yeah. About, is it Tilda Swinton who finds like a genie, and Idris Elba's the genie that comes out of the bottle, and it just looks like a sort of... again, like the kind of way that George Miller tends to make these maximalist, like totally abundant, like stuffed to the brim, like explosions of like kinesis. I'm quite excited to see it.
I think partly because I've kind of been saturated for my entire life with movies and TV programs and stuff and music. It's like kind of, I think I've reached the point where it's like, the other day I was went for a work visit to Norfolk, and we were at Great Yarmouth, and managed to get a couple of minutes where I took the people I was working with, some of the young people I was working with, we were on the beach, and we just walked over to the shoreline with the sea coming in, and just stood there for a minute, just listening, and it was like, I haven't done this enough for a long time. And it was that feeling of stripping all of the stuff that floats around, stripping that away. And I think I maybe need to get away from the city and go on some walking trips. Yeah. You know, maybe go out on a philosophical. I'm reading a book by at the moment. It's kind of like a sort of autobiography by Brian McGee, and about his. He used to be a kind of TV producer, author. But he did philosophy at Cambridge, and he's very critical of that kind of school of philosophy. So I've been plodding through that for the last couple of weeks, and his mainstay was to go in the evening. He lived in London in the 1970s, and he'd be going to theatre and concerts all the time. And you kind of wondering where, you know, kind of that cultural enrichment and that aesthetic. You know, not just looking at things analytically, and you know, the school of philosophy that he describes as the British school, Cambridge school,
the kind of analytic philosophy. Yeah.
Wittgenstein and Bertrand Russell, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's kind of, you know, he's I've just read the chapter where he's talking about Schopenhauer. And about the aesthetic experience, and something that goes beyond just merely. And so we spend our life in a world, you know, to watch it, you know, to go back to your question about Star Wars and stuff like that, it's not a question of thinking it through.
Yeah.
We spend all our time analysing and pulling these things apart. You just have to experience it. And if you're 9 years old, which is who the intended audience of those films are, you experience it in a very different way. If you're an adult and you've seen hundreds of other films, then you're going into it in the wrong frame set.
It's interesting because I do remember, I can't remember how old I was when those films came out, but I do remember going to see them at the cinema, in particular the second one, the Clone Wars one. And thoroughly loving them as a child, because it's just, you know, it's all CGI and there's all sorts of strange monsters and aliens and lightsabers and people fighting and Yoda doing backflips. And I remember thoroughly loving it.
When you're 40 years old and you're going with your mate and acting like 10 year olds, you know, it's something...
But I remember as well, you know, going to see the Clone Wars, and I remember watching it and loving it, and I remember my dad sat right next to me just asleep because he was so bored by the whole film. And I just think now I look back on, I remember thinking at the time, oh, how could you fall asleep during this? This is one of the best things ever. And now it's like, you know what, I get it, fair enough, I'd probably be asleep too.
And one day, you know, you'll be taking kids and your kids or nieces and nephews or whatever to the cinema, and you'll be sitting there going, God, this is what the, you know, it's like, I get that with Frozen.
I'm you know, if I'm ever in that position, I'm taking kids to see art house movies, and that's it. They'll be the ones sleeping through the film.
Well, yeah, and I don't, you know, it's for a long time I find that kind of, what I also find is very off-putting about a lot of cinema is the kind of pretentiousness that goes with it.
Yeah,
and it's a lot of this, you know, film geeks, particularly art house film geeks, are just incredibly knowledgeable about these things, and they know all the minutiae of what the, you know, the back catalogue of what somebody's done, who was assistant director, who was this, that, and the other, where it was shown, all that kind of stuff. And I'm sitting there going, but it's the world's most boring film.
Yeah. Well, I remember as well, because I fell in with, although I was studying philosophy when I was at university, sort of through no fault of my own, fell in with like the film production students and one of the teachers there in particular, and some of these people were really knowledgeable about film. There was this one girl who was just like in a, almost like an encyclopedia of film, and she could pick these things apart and analyze them, and it was really like you could sit there and listen to her for ages if you're interested in film. And she was talking about Citizen Kane one day, because of course she was, and I'd just seen the film, and I thought it was really good. Thank you. But what I thought was really quite funny about that, as she was talking about Citizen Kane, and I'd just watched it, and I didn't know much about the film, but I quite enjoyed it. And she was picking it apart and telling me all the really interesting things about it. And I can't remember how it came up, but it turned out she'd never even seen it. So it's like, if you're able to talk so knowledgeably about these things and pick them apart, but you've never sat there and experienced it as a film, and it feels like something's missing there. Just to watch your mouth drop then was really quite funny, actually.
Well, it's something that's wrong, you know, wrong with the education system, I think, because you get the same thing about books. I was shocked to find out a couple of years ago, and I've moaned about this before, but the A-level syllabus for English literature doesn't require you to read any books. They just give you excerpts from it, and that's where these warnings come in of you might find Hard Times, I don't know, you know, kind of Dickens Hard Times, or you might find, you know, I don't know, Ragged Trousered Philanthropist upsetting because it has negative depictions of poor people, or, you know, there's a scene where there's, you know, sexual assault or something like that. It's like, well, that's the point of a book, to be shocking and to put you out of your equilibrium. And then so to only, you know, for people to only analyse and compare small sections of it seems to me to be absolutely just pathetic.
Well, I don't know if you've talked about this or not, but during lockdown I sort of made it a mission, because I thought I became very worried about the fact that I was, like, in terms of literature, quite poorly read. So I went round and I tried to read some more, like, not necessarily like classic literature, but like literature that people talk about a lot. And I remember that one of the books that people had always talked about as being really good was Fahrenheit 451, for its like philosophical themes and, like, you know, the political dimensions and stuff. And I just remember being, all the way from when I was 16 to 20, hearing people rattle on about this book and thinking, God, that sounds really boring, I think I'll give it a miss, actually. And then I thought, no, you know what, I'll pick it up and I'll read it. And oh my God, it was just really fun. And I feel like that's almost missing. More emphasis needs to be placed on the fact that these books have stood the test of time, because they're very good reads. If somebody had told me, as opposed to waxing philosophically about Fahrenheit 451, that, you know, there were like killer robot spider dogs in it, and that it was actually very funny in a way that, like, you can see, like, the influence that it's had on people like Terry Gilliam, I would have been like, yeah, I'll read that. Because it was genuinely very fun. And the same was to be said of The Count of Monte Cristo when I read that. What a fun book that moves forward at such a quick, well-plotted rate that you can't help but get caught up in this really intricately plotted revenge thriller. It's just brilliant. Like, don't be so pretentious about this stuff.
How many pages is that?
God, like 1,500 or something. But it doesn't... Weirdly enough, it doesn't feel it, because it's so, you know, it almost has, because I suppose it was serialized, and we've talked about this before, the nature of serialization when it comes to storytelling. But I think because it was serialized in such small chunks, it almost has the pace of a comic book, where, like, something interesting happens almost like every 10 pages, and it really pulls you through, and the story moves so quickly and travels such ground in that time that you could almost be reading, you know, I can imagine it being written today as three separate novels or something. It's really brilliant. I thoroughly recommend The Count of Monte Cristo.
I'll add it to my list, my growing list of things that I really ought to be reading. I mean, like yourself, it's like kind of I'm at the moment tending to avoid fiction, which is strange because I used to read a lot of fiction. So it's when you're looking at things like, I mean, Kurt Vonnegut is always on the list of things to recommend. It's the reaction that these things accumulate. And actually, this is something that Brian McGee, because it's fresh in my mind, talks about the kind of he points out that, you know, Cambridge philosophers would regard it as a badge of honour that they'd never read, you know, these analytic philosophers had never read Kant or never read the people that they were critical of. And it's often, it's I think the one thing I'm kind of aware of is that attunement to other people's reactions rather than finding out for yourself. So a good example of this, we went to Norwich in the week, and generally when I've asked people, and similar to my experience with going to Coventry, when I've asked people in the past or have been with people, so do you want to, you know, pop into Norwich, we're nearby, well, you know, it's all right, but, you know, and you kind of take, okay, well, it must be awful then. And then actually when you go yourself, you find out actually it's quite nice, and there's a lot of things there that it's got some really good virtues, and I enjoyed Norwich. I thought it was a great place. I'd highly recommend anybody who wants to go to go. There's a lot of history there. There's, you know, churches, cathedrals, pubs. It's got some really good shops, contemporary shops, bookshops, and all that kind of stuff, coffee shops, which kind of, you know, puts me in my zone, if you like. But it's the pressure that you get from other people that, you know, and at the you know, that's what carries these things along. It's the fannish reaction or anti-reaction that goes with it.
Well, that's why, you know, things like Star Wars have just become bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where they're now too big to fail, because the fact that people love them engenders more people to love them. And so it just keeps growing. Well, then
that's when it becomes an ideology then, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because that it loses its bearing in the evidence of what's being presented. You know, it's other people. An example, recently read Schelling, and he's an idealistic romantic philosopher. It's not none of the sort from what I read. It sounded entirely grounded and pragmatic to me.
Well, this is one of the other things that I think people often forget when, you know, they engage with literally anything, is the vast majority of the time you tend to get out of things what you bring to them, and where you're coming from and the kind of the guiding ideas that you bring to a book tend to colour that to a degree where, you know, there's a reason multiple people have read somebody like Kant or Nietzsche or Heidegger and gone in almost like polar opposite directions with their work.
How do you deal with that kind of peer pressure? So, you know, what's your coping strategy for that? Because it's so easy, whether it's films, comic books, philosophers, you know, what is that? You kind of almost have this thing where you kind of say, well, you know, I've heard bad things about this.
I revel in pissing people off, Rob, so that's me. It's always been a great pride of mine that I never enjoyed the Lord of the Rings movies, that I watched them, and my friend who was so into them made us watch the extended cuts, which I'm sure I've told you before, and I just thought they were boring. And so now I always think it's really funny when somebody brings up Lord of the Rings and how much they love them, and everybody starts chiming in, and I can just stand there and go, oh, crap.
But on the basis that you can put an argument together.
Yeah, as long as, you know, there's nothing wrong with disagreeing with people or even agreeing with people, as long as you've sat there and experienced the thing and formed an opinion about it. Ultimately, like, it's okay to sit there if somebody's talking about something and you don't know anything about it, to just go, oh, I don't know, I've never seen it. But there seems to be a hesitance to cop to that, to say, oh, well, actually, there is that gap in my knowledge. You know, it's like the other day I started reading Derrida, And all I was reading was the introduction by Judith Butler. And I'm sitting there and thinking, I don't understand a word of this.
Not many people do.
Yeah, like, I don't understand a word of this. And so I had to sit there and I turned to my friend at work who's studied a lot of linguistics because he was an English student. So he studied Saussure and Derrida. And I was like, listen, mate, I'm sitting here reading this. What on earth is the trace? What is difference? Like, I don't get it. And then he was able to sit there and explain it to me. And then I got it. And I was like, oh, okay. I feel better now. You know, that when you admit that you don't know something, it gives you a chance to grow. But if you just sit there and pretend that you've read it or pretend that it ish or that it's great.
But you also have to have that conversation with somebody else about it, I think.
Yeah.
Because, and the situation can be then wrapped up with you're talking to somebody outside of a state, outside of an institution, so it doesn't really matter. Nobody else in the office is interested in your interests in this.
And ultimately,
if you're in a university setting, it gets wrapped up in, oh, I've got to agree with what this person says because they're going to be able to give me my. One of the challenges is that people think that things have got to be about something. And that you're always looking for a function with what you're doing. And it's like, no, the trick is for me is to decouple from that kind of very functional way of thinking. And kind of it just, you know, it's like me standing on the beach the other day, listening to the sea washing over the pebbles and you know, kind of standing on the sand and just kind of letting it is what it is. It happens.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you just be and then, rather than thinking, well, there's something I need to get out of this, or I've got a life plan, I've got a set of strategic objectives, I've got a, you know, and there's a load of outcomes that I want to get from this. It's like, no, you just got to let go of all that kind of
stuff. Life plans, who needs those, Rob?
Well, yeah. Do you have a life plan?
No.
I'm not sure I ever did. Yeah. Hence, I'm a massive, you know, burnt out old fart.
God, it's like looking into the future almost. Oh, maybe I should get a life plan.
You should,
yeah.
You should indeed.
Lest I end up like Rob. No. I don't know. I've never, you know, I mean, we started doing these more out of a sense of like, I don't know, what else are we going to do? I mean, I got into contact with you because I was working for a local charity and they said, oh, you know, you should go speak to Rob. He's really good at like radio and radio training and stuff. And he's very knowledgeable. He's like, all right, I'll go. Then it turns out like, oh, I actually quite enjoy these conversations. And then over time, it's just sort of evolved into, okay, everybody else, I don't know where everybody else is now, but it's just still you and me sitting in a coffee shop having a chat.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I suppose what I've learned is don't explain.
Yeah.
Just keep doing it. The problem is internal, you know, you've got to be in an environment where you are lifted up to want to do something rather than, I think sometimes the environment locally can feel as if everything's pushing down and kind of saying, yeah, well, yeah, it's kind of, there's always a reason for not doing something, and there's never a reason where people will say, yeah, okay, that sounds good, you know. So you stop asking after a while. It's like, you know, you're the person who walks into the room and you say, yeah, who wants a cup of tea? And you're met with silence. So you kind of eventually you just stop asking people.
Yeah.
And you kind of go, well, you know, and then you try the next place, and it's like, anybody else want a cup of tea? And it's like, no. Anybody want to talk about Derrida? No. You know, anybody want to talk about movies? And and you have this kind of expectation. I think this is legitimate. I think a kind of one of the things I often question myself a lot about, whether it's me just moaning or whether this is actually a legitimate thing to be concerned about and I should start to develop some solutions for, which is that the lack of educational ambition.
Yeah.
And that we live in a world, certainly here in the UK, which is just playing down to intellectually, and which is not raising anybody's ambitions and is not raising the scope to say, look, there's another way of imagining the future, which just isn't about consumerism, cars, property values, and fairly facile, you know, holidays where all you're doing is stacking up experience and not really learning anything.
Yeah.
And I think a good question, you know, if you stop most people in the street and say, what have you learned recently? And then most people would look at you blankly, you know, and wouldn't be able to engage with you. And that's probably the overriding question that we should be asking. All this experience that we're living through, well, what are we learning?
Yeah, well, this is why, to draw back on something that you were talking about earlier, this is why, you know, I found that in my workplace in particular, you can ask people these kind of questions like, oh, do you want to talk about Derrida? And they'll say no. But it's almost like a form of... sympathetic magic, like what you put out into the world like kind of comes back. So I won't ask people if they want to talk about these things now. I'll just start talking about them. I'll just start talking at people about the things that I'm interested in. And then before you know it, like the people that kind of are slightly interested in these things but might not be willing to admit it or know enough to think that they can have a conversation about these things, because I mean, I don't know enough about these things really to have a conversation, but I will do anyway. And this is sheer pigheadedness of it all. People will start talking to you and engaging with those things with you, and it's like, okay, and then before you know it, you're sat around a group of people and you're all having a conversation about like the nature of Christianity and Heidegger, and it's like, oh, how did this happen? Yeah, because I was too stupid to
keep that shit.
Yeah, exactly. It happened because I'm a loudmouth who can't keep his ideas to himself.
Maybe that's where I went wrong. I thought I had to give not to overproject myself in those circumstances. Mm. So you come from you edit yourself. And it's like kind of what you do. You say, well, I am actually interested in this. I'm not saying, and as you say, I'm not very good at it. And there's people out there who are so much more knowledgeable and have been trained and taught well. But I just find it interesting. And it's nice to sit and try things out and learn to develop it's like the muscle memory of having those conversations. As long as you don't become dogmatic about it and fixed and think that the only thing that you can do is talk about what you learned 30 years ago. You know, there's lots of water goes under those bridges that needs to change your perspective and stuff. And you know, it comes back to what have we learned? You know, the will to knowledge.
Yeah, and I feel like you can't get there and you can't be willing to learn if you're not willing to sit there. And when somebody starts a conversation with you, if you can't say, well, I don't know, but I'll still engage with you in this conversation because I want to learn, there's an element of, there's such a fear of ignorance that it stops people from growing. And it's that growth that's more interesting than the actual knowledge. Because if it'd be very easy for people to sit there and not learn anything new and just talk about things that they learned at university 5, 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Well, on the back of reading this Brian McGee book, I've got a copy of Karl Popper's The Open Society, which is now on my incredibly growing pile again of books to read. And it's quite a weighty collection of thoughts and stuff. But his argument is, as far as I understand it, having not read it yet, is that the basis of a functional society is a liberal society, in terms of we have to have an element of liberalism we've learned, because otherwise you stop being able to anticipate change, do problem solving. If you're not free to express your thoughts, then you live in a totalitarian society and they inevitably end in destruction. The society implodes in on itself, or it picks wars with people to assert itself, but it functionally inside it's kind of broken. So that model of kind of liberal thinking, which is not very fashionable today, there's a lot of it kind of gets criticised as, if you call yourself a liberal, it's like mocked almost by many people. But it is the fundamental element there of kind of having an open mind, being prepared to discuss and engage with other people and accepting that they have an open mind. So that kind of, maybe not as far as Locke and Mill, but it's part of that tradition.
Yeah. Well, there's an element as well that I think some people always forget about, that element of like liberalism and having an open mind and letting people have their say. It doesn't mean everybody's right. You know, people can still be wrong. It's not like suddenly truth disappears. The idea is simply that, to my understanding of it is, in a liberal society, if you allow people to talk about the ideas and discuss them, inevitably the truth will out, because those poor ideas will be weeded out and destroyed by the better ideas. And then before you know it, you know, you keep that keeps going, and people keep talking about things, and people, things move forward at a natural pace.
And we don't have, I mean, do we have enough deliberation within our culture, within our society? Are we locked into, you know, there's massive issues and challenges and problems which almost can't just be talked about? Yeah. Or some things which are over-talked about?
I don't know, because it also feels like the element of, you know, deliberation in, like, a public sense, like, be it politically or culturally, it always feels very, very, very cut off from any system of power to do anything about that deliberation. Everybody feels more and more cut off from the machinery of these.
Well, do you feel that you can? And feel free to ask me impossible to answer questions. Do you feel that you can take the role of a public intellectual? Would you put yourself, you know, you put yourself, would you be accepted as somebody who is a, I hate this phrase because it's a really dodgy phrase, thought leader? Do you offer yourself out as somebody who's got some opinions about things, but it's grounded opinions, and you're invited into discussion forums, and you could walk into a public meeting and people would recognise you as being a kind of a thoughtful kind of, you know, thinker? I went to a thing in Sheffield when we were, Now the caffeine's kicking in. I can remember what I've actually done the last couple of weeks. Well, I went to a Festival Ideas event up in Sheffield, and it was about civic engagement and deliberation. And there's a guy there, his name escapes me, and he's an architect based in Birmingham, and he was quite interesting. He put forward some, was it Rimi, his name? I'll have to look it up on Twitter. He put forward some really interesting ideas, and he understood, he was familiar with some of the metamodern stuff. Rather than putting forward, like, you know, we need systems change, it was like kind of, well, you know, the system will sort itself out if we change this. You know, so he was more interested in symbolic change than systems change. But I kind of didn't stay for all of it, because it kind of almost veered down the route of being a conversation about power and capitalism and patriarchy and things like that. And it's kind of, I feel powerless to change any of that. But I can have a conversation with some people which is about sharing other conversations.
Yeah.
So, okay, I can't do anything about that, but I can have a chat with you about how to improve, how to have a chat about these things at that level, you know. And it just struck me as kind of, you know we get wrapped up in thinking we've got to change the big stuff, and it's the small stuff that needs to
be the change you want to see in the world, Rob.
It's like that hideous cliche that's used by, you know, marketing, you know, CEOs who've been to some inspirational quotes.
Yeah. What's that Michael? Site. What's that Michael Jackson song?
You are the world.
Start. Yeah, start with the man in the mirror, Rob.
Yeah. Well. So yeah, if any he had lived by example, you know, but yeah, I've wandered off and we've been train of thought now in terms of, but that, you know. Do you feel that do you get invitations from people to say, you're articulate, you can speak well about this, you know? You're not invited into a radio programme on BBC Radio Leicester to consider the existential crisis of contemporary...
Well, you've invited me to come here and have talks on your radio show, so I'm going to say, yes, I am a thought leader. Yes, I am a public figure and a public intellectual. But then again, I am a narcissist, so I would think that, wouldn't I?
Yeah, but there's an element to that. You're not so much of a narcissist that, you know, that goes beyond the norm.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, it's, but the, the element to that of you're prepared to have a go with this. Mm. It's kind of it's that's not easy to get people to kind of go.
No. Well, I remember I remember the first couple of times, definitely the first time we sat here and we had a chat. I remember being not paralyzed with nerves, but thinking, oh man, people are going to realize I'm stupid.
What's the whole point? Sorry.
And then I realized, like you always say, you know, nobody's listening. Treat it like that. If people do listen, that's great. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I'm here to have a chat with you and to figure out my own ideas. And because that's how I've always figured things out and where I stood. It's never by sitting in a cold, dark room by myself. It's by talking to somebody else. And often you'll start, or I used to start a sentence thinking I believed one thing and then end a sentence realizing that I actually didn't. Because it's easy to get caught up in you know, the jargon and the buzzwords and the terminology. And then when you sit down and try to flesh that out into a conversation, you're like, actually, no. Like, I think this other thing, which is
a mid-sentence,
yeah,
suddenly dawns on you what you're about to say is actually something that you don't. You suddenly see beyond. You have that flash of intuition,
yeah,
where you suddenly see beyond that original proposition that you were putting forward, and you move on to something else.
Yeah, and that's a difficult a thing that I think I've struggled with, and I think that a lot of people struggle with. It's a difficult thing to admit to yourself, especially when, you know, sometimes if you're having a conversation about something that you thought you felt passionately about. And then you realize, actually, I don't want that to be a part of who I am.
Yeah.
I don't agree with that. I think that's a useful skill to be able to have as well, to sit there and think, and to say, even, to verbalize, oh no, actually, you're right, I was wrong, and now I'm going to change my mind. I don't think a lot of people can do that.
No, we're not trained for it. We don't have the cultural space for it.
Mm.
And invariably in the UK, it's done over a pint. And you know, one of my favourite sayings at the moment is, don't leave a good conversation in the room.
Yeah.
Put it up on, share it. You know, if we have millions... So again, because it's fresh in my mind, I'm always like this. When I read a book, it's fresh in my mind, and then I completely forget about it. Ask me what I read 6 months ago, and I can't recall.
I remember when you were always talking about Coleridge.
Yeah, well, yeah. I was going to go back to that in a bit, but McGee's talking about, he was a TV producer in the 70s, and he did some programs with, it was on the Sunday evening God slot, so kind of 6, 7pm, and they did Thames Television did a series of programs where he was in conversation with a leading religious figure in the country, so an archbishop, you know, kind of what's the word I'm looking for, a rabbi, you know, and he'd have these things for an hour of just a conversation, and he'd say, you know, how can we prove that God exists? And they'd talk about this on primetime ITV.
That's fantastic.
None of the tapes were kept. Nobody made any transcripts. They were all just wiped. So these conversations...
Probably for football.
...were had. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because videotape was expensive at the time, and nobody even kept an audio recording of it. They're just wiped. They're gone. Those conversations never... The listeners in the TV Times or the Radio Times, and the listening's there, but there's no record of what the conversation and discussion was about. It just went. And that, you know... In a TV, they went through the trouble of putting together this, putting it in a TV studio, broadcasting it, and then didn't keep it. And you're kind of looking at it now and you think, my God. But the mindset was, well, nobody else is going to be interested in this afterwards.
It makes me wonder, because I've thought about it before, how much that is culturally interesting has just been lost. Because I remember when I was getting into Monty Python and hearing the story about how they wanted to wipe all of the Monty Python tapes again so they could record more football. And Terry Gilliam was thought, no, I'm not having that. All of the animation that I spent years and years of my life on, and hours of time and effort and sweat and blood and tears in, I'm not just going to have that wiped. I'm going to buy all of those tapes. And if it wasn't for that, I mean, you wouldn't be able to watch those things now. And you think, like, whether you like them or not, I feel it's culturally significant. It's a good thing that we still have them and can view them. And it makes me wonder, how much has been lost. I mean, there are whole swaths of Doctor Who that people can't watch anymore because, you know, these things are just seen as admittedly way more pop culture examples than, like, the genuinely interesting stuff that you would talk about. But that stuff's just gone forever now.
Yeah, and that thing of its moment. But we've got the technology now to keep an archive stuff, you know, endlessly, and, you know, shove stuff up on YouTube and put it out as podcasts, and
for better or for worse.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, why wouldn't you want to capture your conversations and put them out there? Because we're going to learn something about the process of reflection. I think. I mean, this is one of the things I like about this process, and reflecting back on the same process is that process of emergence of our ideas and thinking. So you need to be in a dialogue to do that. It goes back to Socrates.
Yeah,
and you need to be in, you know, smart enough to say I kind of accept that I don't know very much, and then you've got a good basis for a conversation.
Yeah.
And there are times when you would ask somebody, just tell us everything that you know, and you know, you listen to people's stories, you listen to them explain something, and it's incredibly useful. And there's times where you'll sit there and say, we need to figure out what's coming next. And the person with the stories and the person with the list of achievements and all that kind of stuff, great. We can, you know, that can take a bounce. But they can't tell you what's going to come next. Nobody can tell you what's going to come next.
Well, that was one of the things that was really interesting when you asked me to do those Vox Pops for you. When I just, you know, walking around the streets of Leicester and being like, some people would give fairly basic answers, boring, you know, buzzwords and stuff, and then as quickly as possible and then leave. But eventually you'd meet somebody and they'd just start talking to you. And they didn't really, it was like they didn't care or realise that they were being recorded and that it would be permanent, and people would stand there. I remember we're sat in like 200 degrees right now, and just down the road is the Friary. And what's the other pub, the blue one that I like?
The Market Tavern.
The Market Tavern. Somebody came out of the Market Tavern, and I remember asking, what do you think of Leicester? And suddenly he launched into his whole life story and, like, when he'd been abroad and his experiences as a football hooligan. And I thought, man, this is brilliant.
And it's there.
Yeah.
It's just there waiting to be told.
Exactly.
I watched the Ricky Gervais special on Netflix, which is hot and cold for me, but it's like, I understood his point. But he did make one interesting thing. He said, if you went back 10 years and looked at people's tweets, as people do, looking for controversial statements, nobody was talking about pronouns, you know, or the concern about, you know, should you be able to change and use, which identify with different pronouns. So nobody, it wasn't on anybody's agenda that would be a thing. It's just something that's come into the popular culture over the last 5 years or so. Before then, nobody was even, you know, conscious of it, was aware of it. And I thought that was a really good point of expressing how these things change, and they can change in directions that you didn't anticipate. But, you know, the signs are always there. It's just, where do you look out for them? Where are you sensitive to seeing where the new emerging cultural expression is going
to
come
and
from?
And you have to be willing to change with those times as well. You can't sit there and think, well, you know, oh, this wasn't a thing 10, 20 years ago, so I'm not going to engage with it now, or I'm going to be actively hostile towards it. You have to learn that as things change, you have to and are allowed to change as well. Like, talking to some people that I work with that are, like, you know, between the ages of like 25 and 30, you get the impression that now they're like, okay, I've got this job now and that's it, this is me for the rest of my life, I'm not going to change or adapt or grow, and haven't really since the age of about 16. But that's really not how things work.
You've hit the nail on the head for me. And that is one of the fundamental core problems. And I think I need to start to articulate this more and set the challenge. And going back to Coleridge, that's one of the things Coleridge realised, that the solution to a lot of the problems in the 19th century was the extent to which people were experienced a liberal education, think for yourself, you know, that kind of a notion of independence of thought, and that you people will tell you what they know and what they're comfortable with. But when you ask people, what should we do? What should we be planning for the future? And it's like, I'm not sure. You know, it's like, somebody's going to sort it out. You know, somebody else's problem. It's like, well, no, it's your problem. What should we be planning for? What are the kind of things, what should we be teaching in schools in the next 20 years to ensure that we avert all of these potential crises that we can see, you know, kind of really just falling on top of us now, so we're equipped to deal with this? And, you know, that's partly why I like the kind of meta-modern approach, which is that it does ask that kind of question. And it says, okay, you know, kind of don't just throw everything out with the bathwater, but revisit things and look at, well, do they serve a function? You know, is there not just a kind of virtue signalling function to your ideological concerns, or is there a practical function in terms of how we empower people to make changes themselves, rather than only ever being the people who changes forced upon? And then you have to do that thing of trying to catch up and trying to adapt. So change in the context of, I agree with you about change, but the context in which change happens isn't as straightforward as leaving it just to individuals. Mm. So, you know, the world changes, people's values change. Some people's languages were founded and ideas were founded many years ago. And it's okay not to be up to speed with the contemporary way of describing or explaining things, as long as you're open to the idea that things are changing.
Yeah.
And that what you don't do is you don't then also, you know, you might have your views, but you don't prevent other people from expressing their views. No. And exploring these emergent issues.
Yeah. Ultimately, a problem only really arises when you start attacking people, when, you know, these things become directed at people and they start to become almost entirely mean-spirited. You know, it's fine to talk about ideas and to discuss things, but okay. Change is good.
Right, okay, so anything you're doing have you got anything planned this week?
I do.
Anything you can report?
Anything I can report on? I've started reading, rereading Nietzsche's The Gay Science. So I'll be reading, you know, dipping in and out of that on the bus and when I've got a spare couple of moments. Massive stack of comics to read. I did want to start reading some of those Philip K. Dick books that you gave me a couple weeks ago as well. So we'll see, really.
I think I've got a podcast recording on Monday to do, so that's nice to get back into the swing of doing some more podcasts and maybe try and get a bit of writing. I've got a lot of editing to do from the trip to Norfolk, so that's going to take up a lot of my time, which would be nice, and a couple of other projects to work on. So and I'm getting to the point where I feel as if I need to take a week off, which I've not done for a while. So yeah.
Now that nice weather's out, Rob, it's the time to do it.
Well, one would hope, but it's freezing. You know, it's like the wind yesterday was lovely and bright and sunny, but the wind was bitter. It was like blowing from the north. Anyway, right, so how do people get in contact with you?
They can't. No. I'm on Twitter at Clayton Comics with an X instead of a C and an S.
And I'm on Twitter at Rob and Instagram at Rob W Media. The website is robwattonmedia.net. You can leave a donation to support the podcast and the coffee that we buy
caffeinators,
while we do it.
Please.
It's caffeinators by leaving a donation on Patreon, which the details are on the website. But until next time, thanks very much.
You've been listening to Distraction Therapy with me, Rob Watson. Find out more at robwatsonmedia.net or follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Rob W Media.